Well, there's a couple things going on right now that I don't think have ever happened before. The first one I knew about. The other one I did not. And that's, I've got somebody on the line who wants to talk about something we were talking about last night. And listen, if you've been burning up since last night wanting to say something about what we were talking about 24 hours ago, I got to talk to you right off the bat. Before we even introduce the show, before I even tell people who I am, I want to hear from Lena in Grand Forks. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. I hate to burst your bubble, but I was listening to it just a couple hours ago while I was cooking dinner.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I was, it was misrepresented to me. Gotcha.
Well, so just to kind of set the stage here, I listen to you and Justice and Drew just about every day.
Appreciate that.
Both of you have recently been talking about discrimination against more conservative people and people who follow more Christian ideology.
Correct.
And so I'm 26 years old, and just this last Easter, I was baptized Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, I was born and raised atheist. And so while my parents and my family are very respectful, kind people, we just never followed any particular ideology at all.
Okay.
And ever since becoming Christian, more specifically Catholic, I have never felt more discriminated against in this country than I do right now.
Wow.
Like, between Facebook and my brother lives in Minneapolis. He's more conservative, but all of his friends and our mutual friends are all so aggressively liberal. I just feel like talking about the hypocrisy regarding the red hen versus, I can't remember. Last night you compared the red hen to something else. Oh, the gay baker.
And for in case people aren't familiar with the story, the Red Hen is the restaurant that kicked Sarah Huckabee Sanders out in Virginia over the weekend. And that, of course, was the source of some controversy.
Yes. And then, so with what you've said about how the Red Hen, you compared it to the owner of the Red Hen was saying how, I guess, kind of moral she felt kicking out Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Right. What she said was that we've reached a point in our culture where people have to make, I believe the words were, uncomfortable and, you know, potentially confrontational decisions in order to uphold their moral values, which was a statement that I found interesting because it implies that the decisions we make about the relationships we enter into and the transactions that we consent to have an underpinning of expression about who we are and what we believe, and that's important. And if indeed that's important when you're making a decision about whether or not you're going to serve Sarah Huckabee Sanders, it's also important when you're making a decision about whether or not you're going to bake a cake for a gay wedding.
Right. And how uncomfortable is it to look someone in the eye and say, I'm sorry, but because of your lifestyle, I'm going to choose to refuse your money. How uncomfortable is that?
Right.
Or me talking to a friend of mine who is of equal age and an equal place in their life, and they're asking me why I haven't attended a gay pride rally, saying, because frankly, I think that you're living in sin, and it's kind of, I want nothing to do with it.
Right.
Like, how uncomfortable is that?
It's not comfortable, but often standing on your principles isn't. And, you know, it kind of speaks to the fact that you evoke comfort, I find interesting, because one of the words that's often bantied about is courage or bravery. Whenever somebody stands up and proclaims their liberal bona fides, signals their virtue. You know, the example that comes to mind is when Oprah got up in front of, I think it was a Golden Globe audience that's populated with people who adore her and want to be her and want to be hired by her, right? Populated by all of her friends and all the people who agree with her ideologically, and gets in front of them and very courageously declares that rape is bad, which I didn't think any of us needed that lesson. Like, I didn't think we needed to be convinced that rape is bad, but apparently that's the bravest thing that anybody's ever done, going in front of a completely friendly audience and saying something that nobody disagrees with. When in actuality, what takes courage is to stand up in those situations that you're referencing, where you have something to lose. You have something to genuinely push back against you and to mm-hmm. deprive you of something that you actually value. You know, whether that be a community's respect or the sustenance of your business, whatever the case may be, because you're standing upon something that you believe that's unpopular.
Yes, and I think another example of that, at least relevant to my life, is talking to other mid-20-year-old women, and I'm getting married in October, and when I tell them I'm just kind of killing time until I can be a stay-at-home mom, they look at me like I'm an alien.
Right?
And I just think it's so sad, because just my parents are a little bit older. My mom was 38 when I was born, but like to them, it was so crazy that my mom was the breadwinner in my family.
You know what I find interesting?
It's just a generation later. It's crazy that I want to be a stay-at-home mom.
Have you watched by chance? I know this is, you know, I'm kind of casting a line out here, but have you watched the Netflix show Love, the Judd Apatow?
I've heard you talk about it.
Yeah.
And Mad Men reminds me a lot of your description, because they're all so obviously reaching for something that they're just not getting.
Yeah, there are plenty of examples you can point to in art, in drama, where this type of searching and longing for something that's really obvious and right in front of you, but you don't want to accept it. So in the case of this show, Love, it's about this couple that's in the process of getting together. And both of them individually are kind of dealing with the fact that they want to find vindication and satisfaction and comfort and a sense of security and purpose and the security that they're actually moving forward with their lives in a positive direction. And all of that could be achieved by this old-fashioned thing known as marriage, right? But it can't possibly be. Like, there's one scene where the female lead actually says marriage can't possibly be the answer. That's just ridiculous. That's old fashioned. But everything that she's searching for feebly through her the other mechanisms and her other relationships points to that. Like, ultimately that's what she wants, but she can't admit to herself that that's what she wants. And I think that that's a metaphor for so many of the things in our modern society, where the answers are really simple and traditional and obvious. But because they're simple, traditional, and obvious, people don't want to accept that that's the answer, because it's got to be something new and it's got to be something edgy.
Well, I mean, it's you're the radio host, so maybe you can't say it. So I'll say it, as the recently baptized Catholic, that intended things in a certain way, and we don't need to reinvent the wheel here. And I just feel, ever since I've gotten engaged, just there's such... If you're familiar with the phrase freedom through discipline, there is so much freedom I feel through just committing to one person and investing in that one person and knowing that one person is so thoroughly investing in me too.
Right.
And it's a life we can build together. Like, there's so much freedom in that partnership. And I'm very happy to accept the discipline of making that relationship work.
Well, Lena, it's been fantastic to hear from you tonight. I appreciate you calling the show. I hope you'll continue to listen and continue to call, because I love your insights.
I'd be happy to.
All right. Have a good night. Well, how about that? How about them apples? Walter Hudson, by the way, closing argument, the name of the program. I usually tell you that right off the bat, but I just had to get to that call because I just found it so unusual that somebody was waiting for me before I even got on the air tonight. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Brad Omlin back in the house. Taking your phone calls, producing the show. Great to have him back. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. The other thing we got going on tonight that's highly unusual, we have a candidate for U.S. Senate in studio with us tonight who's running as a Democrat, and that's not the unusual part. Like, that's unusual enough, but in the next hour or so that we have a conversation, I assure you, you are more likely to agree with him on the various policy issues we tick through here over the course of the next hour than with me. So we got a Democrat in studio whose positions on the issues are more likely to be aligned with yours as the likely conservative listener than they are with mine. So let's dive right into it. Steve Carlson is in studio with us, running for the U.S. Senate as a Democrat. Which lane? Are you going for Tina Smith's seat or for... Push your on button there. Sorry, I should have given you the tutorial.
Is it on now or no?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. Yeah, Amy Klobuchar.
Amy Klobuchar's seat. Okay.
That's correct. Yeah, hi, Walter. Thanks for having me on. I'd like to present my case for getting the votes of all your listeners in the upcoming primary August 14th against incumbent U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. And the early voting for the Senate primary actually starts this Friday, June 29th. And the DFL is getting their faithful out to support their endorsed candidates. But listeners should reject the incumbent Amy Klobuchar and another endorsed candidate, Ilhan Omar, and I'll get into that. But I also am here to participate in and really to celebrate talk radio, which is really unique to the United States, our great country, because it's built on freedom of speech, freedom of expression. And yet it's also about the serious business, and your listeners are about the serious business of self-governance, using our freedoms and liberty to actually, to a large degree, govern ourselves. It's an amazing enterprise, and yet at the same time, a fragile enterprise, as Maxine Waters is driving home in last year's mass shooting of Republican congressmen while they were playing baseball, drives home. And that's my opening introduction there.
All right. Well, I appreciate your offering it. Now, we should talk a little bit about how this came about that you're even sitting here.
Sure.
We had... Bob Anderson, who's running for the other Senate seat that's up this year as a Republican. He's going for the seat currently held by Tina Smith. And he is challenging the Republican-endorsed candidate in a primary. We had him on, I believe it was Thursday or Friday. Perhaps it was, it doesn't matter. And I don't know if you were listening to that show or he contacted you during the show, but I started hearing from you like that night as I'm going home. I started getting tweets from this guy, Steve Carlson.
That's right.
And listen, I had known of you prior, you know, during my Tea Party years.
Okay.
I recall seeing your name and seeing your tweets, and I don't remember the exact context, but what's the background there? Because you're running as a Democrat. But a lot of the ideas that you're standing for, like you're a supporter of Donald Trump, is that fair to say?
I think that's very fair.
And a lot of the ideas that you're running on would typically be characterized as conservative ideas. So what's the story behind that?
Okay, well, I don't really like to get in politics, believe it or not. I was very happy being out of politics. I have a background at the University of Minnesota in the government there, but... when I saw what was happening when Obama came into office and mm-hmm. with the healthcare crisis, and the other thing that really triggered me was the Gitmo, when they were going to shut that down and bring it to Thompson, Illinois, which is about 150 miles down the river. I don't know if you've ever looked at that, but it's very close on the Mississippi River. And so I just had to get involved. So I joined the Independent Party, but the reason I did that is because I think I really am a Democrat, but because of these gender quotas and these race quotas, they even have a Somali caucus.
You mean in terms of the candidates they're willing to put up?
No, their quotas are being able to vote. So this is actually a violation of your voting rights, because when you go to a precinct caucus, I went there once for a friend of mine who is a Chicano leader because he wasn't feeling well. So I went there and I tried to get him on as a delegate, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the meeting, this woman who is presiding over the meeting says, well, by the way, the DFL laws and policies require that we have at least 50% women on the voting delegation. That's going to go forward.
I didn't realize they had that.
Yeah, that's in the Constitution, I believe, is under outreach.
So what do they do if they don't even get enough people showing up in the room who are interested in being delegates to fit their quota?
You know, I don't know. But in this case, there were enough women, but they hadn't got on the delegation. So at the end, she says, so I would like you, since your friend, you know, is not here, would he like to be an alternate? Because he's a male. We don't have enough women. And I said, well, I don't think so. And I started going in and talking about his work as the director of Migrants in Action, and he had done so much work. And she says all of a sudden, oh, well, he's a minority. That's okay. And she moved on, and she knocked about eight men off the voting delegation. So to me, I can't vote, I can't participate. And the state law actually says that if you don't agree with this principle, that you can't participate. So I stayed away from that, and I went to the Independence Party. Now, you say that's conservative. I don't really think my ideas are conservative, because maybe we all agree on a lot more than we think. We want to solve the problem.
All right. Well, let's get into a few of those ideas when we return. The first thing I want to talk about, just because it's fresh in the news right now, is the Supreme Court's decision upholding Trump's travel ban, which, of course, leads into a discussion of immigration. I know that's one of the issues you care a lot about, based upon what we've seen on Twitter over the weekend.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that when we return with Steve Carlson, running for U.S. Senate as a Democrat, supporter of Donald Trump, 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling, upheld President Donald Trump's restriction on travel to the United States from a handful of Muslim-majority countries on Tuesday, giving the White House its first high court victory on the merits of a presidential initiative. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, made it clear that the court viewed the ability to regulate immigration as squarely within the president's powers, and he rejected critics' claim of anti-Muslim bias. We express no view on the soundness of the policy, Roberts wrote. In other words, you know, they're not making a value judgment as to whether or not the policy is good. They're just saying that this is, in fact, something that the president gets to do. After a series of federal court rulings invalidated or scaled back earlier versions of the travel ban, the decision is a big win for the administration and ends 15 months of legal battles over a key part of Trump's immigration policy, which opponents attacked as a dressed-up form of the Muslim ban that Trump promised during his 2016 campaign. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855, the number to join us. That story comes to us from NBC News. We have in studio with us Steve Carlson, a candidate for U.S. Senate, running as a Democrat, who happens to have views on immigration that are much more in line with the president of the United States, Donald Trump, than you might expect from somebody who's running for office as a Democrat. Your reaction, Mr. Carlson, to this ruling by the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it was pretty much a non-ruling. As you say, they didn't pass on the policy. They shouldn't pass on the policy. Now, if you look at how this all started, one Sally Q. Yates, who was let go, I guess, by the city of Minneapolis this week. They were going to have her study ketamine, I think.
Yeah.
And that was stopped, and I'm glad. But she actually, when she took over as the attorney general, directed attorneys for the Department of Justice not to appear, not to defend that executive order. And I thought that was atrocious, because I think they are for national security. And this is a big problem that I see with a lot of attorneys general, where they're being very selective on what they're going to do. I never thought this was a Muslim ban, and it isn't a Muslim ban. The problem that we have is that people are trying to get into the country for the wrong reasons. And I think that we need a president who focuses on that, because we have to stop.
What would you characterize as a wrong reason for wanting to get in the country?
Basically, because of ideology, that they want to carry out violence or overthrow the government. And because part of it is growing out of the war. Possibly, you know, famine, refugee situations, the very bad situations that we need to look at and help, and help them on the ground there. Third countries working on the ground with NGOs and things like this, trying to bring peace, and I think work internationally. So really, we need to solve the situation. But until that time, we have a lot of people that are going to Europe and coming to the United States to carry out violence. I mean, we had a person, and people might say he snapped, but he stabbed 11 people
And you're talking about the St. Cloud.
Yeah, in St. Cloud.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous to have a governor that says that if you don't like it, you should leave the state, and that is because of your behavior. I mean, and so this first judge who did this out in Washington was obviously ridiculous. He said, well, I know exactly why you're doing this. This is a very sound principle. I talked about this, by the way, I ran for president as well in as independent beginning in 2015, which is how I spotted Trump. Mm-hmm. And I saw that this is a very, very smart man. And the problem that we all saw then was especially the persecution of Christians. Okay, I mean, I never saw anything.
Are you talking about domestically or overseas?
Overseas.
Okay.
This is where we don't want the people coming from. And so what they would do, I'm talking about people who were killing off these Christians.
Uh-huh.
And some Muslims too. They were slaughtering some Muslims. Kurds, they were all targets. And this was this so-called ISIS thing. And Donald Trump says we have to help these Christians to get away from this because they're being persecuted because they're Christians. And so people said, oh, that's a religious test. Well, no, it isn't. The religious test was they were being targeted, and killed, you know, kids were killed, wives were, they were raped, you know, the usual burning and pillaging kind of thing. And I'm glad that we have to, that we started to vet for that. And I believe that some of those countries have been taken out of that status already, and the vetting is working. And I think it's going to go on to work. I think Donald Trump has made it very clear he's not anti-Muslim, okay? We all recognize that there are a lot of people who are abhorred by this, and very often they're the target of it too. Mm-hmm. But it is apparently part of the Quran and some of the other religious writings that you're supposed to kill people of other religions, exactly what Ben Carson would say.
We need to go to a break, yes, but when we come back, I want to get into, because we're kind of starting to conflate immigration with the question of Islam itself. And I understand that they're related in this instance with the travel ban.
Right.
But I want to go a little bit more into detail regarding some of the underlying legal and moral arguments surrounding the travel ban. And then maybe we can transition into talk more about the Islam stuff as well. Steve Carlson, candidate for U.S. Senate, running as a Democrat, in studio with us tonight. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing argument, 651-989-5855, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. In studio with us tonight, we have Steve Carlson, candidate for the U.S. Senate, seeking the seat currently held by Amy Klobuchar. He's running as a Democrat, but certainly the most unconventional senatorial candidate from the Democratic Party that I've ever encountered. He's a fan of Donald Trump, and he holds positions that many of you may hold as well on issues like immigration and tariffs and the views regarding the threat of Islam and Sharia law and what have you. And we're getting into all of that here tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Brad Omlin producing the show, taking your calls. We got Barry on the line in St. Paul's, got a question for Steve Carlson. Welcome to the program.
So you're going up against Amy Klobuchar, who started out as saying she was a blue dog Democrat, which is kind of the position you're taking, where you're saying, well, I agree with you guys, with the Republicans more than the Democrats on some of these core issues. But the problem that Amy ran into was when she tried to do that, she had all of the Democratic Party against her. How are you going to keep your beliefs that you have and still stay a Democrat and be able to get positions of power that are going to benefit Minnesota? Because let's be honest here, that's what it's about when you go to the national level to be able to get on these committees. How is that going to help us any?
Okay, thanks, Barry, for that question. Well, first of all, I have a lot of parliamentary experience. Okay, I mean, like, I know Robert's Rules of Order, and I get in there, and I get a lot of motions passed, and I get a lot of things done. Now, obviously, when you get into the Congress, they have different rules, but they're essentially the same. Now, as far as the Senate goes, they're the deliberative body. They very often have a 60-vote requirement, and so what you have to do is listen. And I really can listen. I listen to what you said, but I don't know if Amy Klobuchar was really a blue dog Democrat or not, because I can't really detect any values from her. And I don't want to just go off on her in answering your question, but to me, she's pretty much like, I would call her a wallflower. She doesn't really do anything. She has these little projects, which every once in a while she puts in the papers. But let's take one of those, and I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but let me just give you an example of cancer. Okay, now my wife has had breast cancer, and she's been part of this program, which is a federal program, in which the treatment is supposed to be paid for if you're diagnosed under that program. Well, so that program, the state of Minnesota and Amy Klobuchar is going along with this, they're throwing her off 2 years before her cancer treatment was completed, and they're throwing hundreds of Minnesota women off. Now, I don't even think that Amy Klobuchar gets it, what this is about. I mean, this is breast cancer. Now, on the other hand, look at one of her projects. What does she do about cancer? Well, she has a registry for firemen who, yes, firemen get cancer, and it's terrible. But it's going to be really terrible when it turns out, just like it did for the women that were being screened in the 1990 Act, where they just screened them and they watched them die because there was no help available for them to get treatment. And there isn't help available for these firemen either. So she's just trying to do basically nothing. And I am going to work across, I know Al says he worked across the aisle, but I actually do. I have a very good track record. People used to ask me, they read about what I was doing in Minnesota Daily. They say, why are you defending, the option of students to opt out of paying for MPIRG? I mean, weren't you on MPIRG? Isn't that a conservative position? Well, yes, but if the freedom of the students to not be forced to participate in MPIRG, that's something I want to talk with everybody about. And we solved that issue, I thought.
But none of that's going to be the problem. But the problem is going to be, let's say you win, right?
Right.
What's going to happen is the Democratic Party is going to throw everything at you, and they're going to make it a big race in 4 years.
Well,
you're going to lose.
I don't back Chuck Schumer as the minority leader. What I have seen Amy Klobuchar do is stand up beside Chuck Schumer while they were shutting down the government. Now, she wasn't doing it on a blue dog thing. She did it because supposedly they weren't going to solve the DACA issue. And so she voted against a continuing resolution to allow the government to continue. And I have a picture of that on my Twitter feed, which is Steve W. Carlson.
I appreciate the call, Barry. I'll try to follow up here for you.
Thank you.
I think what Barry's getting after is that I think you've established well that you'll be an independent voice. Like, I don't picture somebody pushing you around, a whip coming along and saying you're going to go this way, and you actually being like, okay. Like, that, I don't see that in your character, your personality. But to Barry's point, there is this question of what it's like to caucus with a party, and you're running as a Democrat. And if they want to, they can shut you out of everything. They could shut you, assuming that they're, you know, they have the majority or whatever, they have the control. They can shut you out of the committees. They could shut you out of being able to have much impact or much of a say. So are you effectively running just to kind of be an insurgent voice? Or do you hope to be able to actually accomplish something?
I know I can. The power lies with the people. It always has. It always does. And so we need to address these issues. We have issues like immigration that needs to be solved. Take for instance the children that have been separated from their parents. Well, why is that happening? It's because Amy Klobuchar and the rest of the Democrats, first, they won't do anything now to allow them to be united and not be shut out by that 20-day limit that comes from this court case, Flores versus Reno.
Yeah.
But at the same time, who started this? And I have a video that's about the Wilberforce Amendment. Wilberforce Amendment is about human trafficking. And it says that the government is supposed to take these young girls, who they said 80% of them say they've been sexually assaulted when they get in the United States, and meet with them and see if they really have been, and if they have been, to follow up on that, okay, and to protect them. And if they haven't been, they're going to repatriate them, not back to the other side of the border where they probably will be trafficked, mm-hmm, okay, but back to their countries of origin. Now, I brought that up under Obama. Now, Obama, after the election, he gives all this discretionary authority to prosecutors. And I think they're just, I know some of those girls got put in a case in Ohio where they were put, they're actually slave labor. And
I understand the argument that you're making. What I'm suggesting, and what I think Barry is suggesting, is that having the correct argument isn't going to advance policy. That the institutional reality is, you have to actually have the political support amongst your caucus and frankly, the consent of your leadership in order to be able to do anything.
Well, you know, I don't mean to be disrespectful to the institution at all, but I will want support from Donald Trump. I will want support from moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats, the true blue dog approach. I want to work with them. I want to solve these problems. And as we go through each of my issues, I think you'll find I actually have solutions. I actually understand what the hang-ups are. And I want to say one more thing, and that is that, you know, self-governance has always been limited. You know, our colonies just sort of delegated self-governance to people to solve issues, so that they could be productive. They weren't, it's not some philosophy class, you know, where everybody has to agree. It's things have to get done. Governance has to proceed so that we can have a successful country.
All right. Let's explore one of those issues. Sure. And we're running short on time before we have to go to another break, but I want to get back into the Supreme Court's decision upholding President Donald Trump's travel ban and the broader implications of that. From the Star Tribune, hours after the Supreme Court upheld that ban, Muslim community leaders, immigration attorneys, and advocates from around the Twin Cities decried the decision, saying they fear it will prompt broader immigration restrictions and amplify discrimination against Minnesota's growing Muslim community. And they go on to talk about a news conference that was held by CARE, who I know you're familiar with, the Council on American-Islamic Relations and what have you. And, you know, basically the argument that they're making, the argument that I'm hearing from the left today, is that, you know, they're... It's very fascinating to me because they're evoking all these past decisions that the court has made to uphold horrible things like slavery and Jim Crow and similar moral atrocities, and saying, we've been in this position before where the Supreme Court has failed to take the right and proper decision. And that, of course, is complete hogwash comparing this to that. There's no comparison whatsoever. However, where I agree with them is in the underlying sentiment that there is a difference between what is legal and what is moral. And so we find ourselves in a situation where, you know, I think the court ruled correctly in this instance, in that they interpreted the law as it's written. They interpreted the Constitution as it's written and said this is consistent with the powers that the president's supposed to have under the current law, under current precedent, under our reading of the Constitution. But the legal question being resolved in that manner says nothing about the underlying moral question. And that's what I'm interested in. And unfortunately, you're going to have to make it quick, and then we can come back to it after the break. But I'm interested in this moral question of what it means to have rights. Because, you know, a lot of the arguments that I hear from people who are hardcore on immigration, hardliners on immigration, is, well, the Constitution doesn't apply to non-citizens. It doesn't apply to aliens. It certainly doesn't apply to illegal aliens. So you can't cite your constitutional rights when you're coming here from somewhere else. But don't these rights that we refer to that are referenced in the Constitution, don't those rights pre-exist the state? Don't they pre-exist the Constitution? Aren't they inherent in the fact that a human being exists as such? How then can it be truthfully said that somebody who's not from here doesn't have those rights?
And of course, they do have the rights, and the Constitution is the greatest thing. And as they learn the Constitution, they're going to benefit greatly. This is the same argument that we brought up with Ben Carson and Donald Trump when I was running in 2015 for the independence as a candidate for president. And that is that you have to comply with the Constitution. Like the your earlier caller said, once you abide by those rules, you have so much freedom and so much liberty, you're going to love it. You're not going to have to adhere to something that is inimical, that views as an enemy this Christian-based Constitution, which is basically based on grace and compassion and rejects the workings of strict law that somebody can get a hold of and do injustice to you. So this is something that's going to allow you freedom. We have to tone down the rhetoric. We're in a 24/7 news cycle, and people actually believe, some people, they're actually convinced by what the fake news says. It's not true. There's no reason to panic, and it's a time for dialogue. And I don't think Trump is going to take any actions against Muslims. I don't, like I say, he's trying to just screen out the kind of people who are going to be doing harm to everybody, including those Muslims.
Steve Carlson, candidate for U.S. Senate, running as a Democrat. My name's Walter Utz. In closing argument, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name's Walter Utzon. 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. In studio, we have Steve Carlson, a candidate for U.S. Senate, running as a Democrat, but he's not like any Democrat you've encountered before. He's a fan of President Donald Trump, and he holds a lot of positions on issues that you would more commonly associate with conservatives or Republicans, particularly issues like immigration, tariffs. Nowadays, tariffs. Republicans used to have a different position on tariffs just a couple of years ago, but that's apparently flipped now that we have Donald Trump as the standard bearer of the party. We'll get into that next hour. Right now, I want to focus a little bit more on immigration as such. There's, of course, a story here out of Reuters. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. Parents who cross illegally from Mexico to the United States with their children will not face prosecution for the time being because the government is running short of space to house them, officials said on Monday. So it's an interesting situation where, you know, Trump initiated this zero tolerance policy at the border where we're going to prosecute any adult who illegally crosses and, you know, take them through the whole process. And that triggered this 1997 decree that we referenced earlier, whereby children can't be detained more than 20 days by the government. They have to be shifted into, you know, some sort of alternative custody. And that was the dreaded separation of families. And so in order to address that, the president signed this executive order basically directing his lawyers to seek a judicial remedy to that. And now in the aftermath of that executive order, they're basically admitting, listen, we don't have the capacity to do this. Like, we don't have the resources available to prosecute everyone and detain everyone and detain their families. What's your view, first of all, on, you know, this particular situation where, you know, do we need to engage in massive construction efforts? Do we need to build, you know, twice as many detention centers in order to hold all these families? Or is there something more fundamental wrong with the status quo of immigration policy that needs to change?
Okay, well, we do need a massive construction effort to build the wall. And as we build the wall, they're going to see that we're not just trying to keep people out. We're trying to build a safe, secure area where people from both sides of the border can live and have a good neighbor relations that were envisioned under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which in 1848 created that wall. Now, as far as this situation, I don't agree that they're admitting they don't have the resources.
Well, I mean, that's literally what they've said.
Well, not really. Because I think you need to look behind it. You mentioned that they're supposed to seek a judicial remedy, right? Well, that's going to require the filing of a lawsuit. So as I see it, they're probably going to pick out a case that they can bring to the Supreme Court that is exemplary of the rest of what they're trying to do and win that case. They're also trying to get Amy Klobuchar, Tina Smith, all the rest to vote to extend that 20-day limit. And now you're starting to hear arguments, oh, you can't do that because now we're condemning children to indefinite incarceration. So you can't win no matter what you do.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think that we can go past 20 days. I agree with what Trump is doing now. I said this, and this is what the Wilberforce Amendment did. It screened people to see, do you have any credible case, any scenario in which you could stay in this country? And if the answer is no, then no, you don't need to see a judge. Because what judges do is they look at questions of law, and they shouldn't have to deal with questions of fact. Those should be able to be dealt with in an administrative hearing. I mean, that's not always the way you want to do it, but very often, we have a law in Minnesota that you can't discuss the Constitution when you're in an administrative hearing for the Department of Health of Human Services. You get your cancer treatment taken away with no discussion. You can't say it's unconstitutional. So just because you cross the border doesn't mean you need to have a long, dragged out, you know, months long with every lawyer that wants a job to come in and make things up. So like Trump is saying, well, hey, if we're very sorry, but we have laws and you don't qualify, I think they should repatriate them back to their country of origin. They shouldn't just kick them across the border, Mexican border. And this is very humane. And once it's done, people will stop this. Now, there are big problems in those countries, and we need to help with that.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary for the White House, said, according to Reuters, this will only last a short amount of time because we're going to run out of space. We're going to run out of resources in order to keep people together, and we're asking Congress to provide those resources and do their job. So that's the admission from the White House that they are, in fact, running out of resources. And, you know, whatever the legislative solution to that may be, we know how slowly the gears of legislative, you know, undergoings take.
I think the courts will move faster. I think they can get this into the courts when they have the right case.
Steve Carlson, candidate for U.S. Senate, in studio with us. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. We've spent the first hour getting to know Steve Carlson, who's a candidate for U.S. Senate, running as a Democrat, who holds the interesting distinction of being a fan of Donald Trump, the current Republican president in the United States, and holding many positions that are in sync with the sitting president. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. We stream on TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. 651-989-5855 is the number to contribute to the program. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. All right, I want to get into some of the controversies potentially that can emerge between us. This whole thing started, you know, the reason we have you in the program was over a disagreement on tariffs, and we'll get to that eventually, but I want to stick with immigration here for a second. And I want to throw a couple of premises at you and see how you respond to them. The first one is, you know, regarding the issue of the border itself. We commonly hear it described in the debate about illegal immigration. We commonly hear language that describes the border, like the existence of the border, as being dependent upon enforcement of immigration law. You know, you'll hear terms like, you know, the border means something. And Trump said this during the campaign. The border means something, and in order for it to mean something, we have to enforce our laws. We have to enforce immigration. You hear rhetoric along the lines of the Democrats and the leftists and the open borders crowd are trying to destroy the border. You hear terminology like anarchy at the border and things of this nature. We have all kinds of political borders within the United States of America. There are borders between municipalities, cities, counties, political districts, school districts, legislative districts. And people cross these borders, these lines on maps, every day, all the time, without chaos, without anarchy. What fundamentally is different about the national border that requires these types of restrictions about who's crossing it and under what circumstances?
So I guess you're distinguishing not between the four sides of our national borders, but between national borders and other kinds of borders?
What's special about a national border that requires control over how and when it's crossed?
Well, okay, because with our Constitution, all right, we're all part of the government. We all have rights as citizens. And so one of the things that's happening now is that that's being diluted. And citizens feel that, you know, they're second place, that other people are being helped by our public policy mm-hmm. and not them. And, you know, people say, well, this is, you know, the country was based on immigrants, it's made up of immigrants,
right.
but it's made up of citizens. And there are a lot of people who see this and say, wait a minute, it's not made up of immigrants. They might once have been immigrants, but now they're citizens. And if you want to be a citizen, you should go through the proper process, because citizens are important, because the society's important. We have voting. The voting rights can't – you have non-citizens. They're trying to vote in certain elections like educational school board or something like this. There may be a role, you know, a role that the citizens can do in these places. But it should reside with the citizens to make the decisions to govern the country. And then we can expand that to other people. Now, at the border, the open border policy, it truly does destroy the border. I saw somebody was arguing with me online over the weekend that it's just everybody is kind of, I think it was supposed to be a libertarian argument, you know. A person has absolute right to cross the border whenever he wants. Well, if that was true, then we could have the people that you're fleeing for your asylum,
right.
they can cross
they
the border.
You, yeah,
you know,
right.
how can we stop them, you know? So there wouldn't be any asylum. It would be blown out of the water. So asylum and all of these other compassionate policies and great programs that our country is based on, they have to be based on citizens. You know, in Minnesota, we used to have white citizens was in our Constitution. It had to be removed after the Civil War, but the circumstances were the Indians, the Ojibwe and the Dakota, weren't allowed to vote. They were seen as having their own sovereign nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was put in there. And so from the very beginning in our naturalization, we had to control who was creating this great country. And then other people could.
Isn't there a distinction, however, even historically, between mm-hmm. the process of naturalization and immigration? Because it occurs to me, and perhaps I just don't know my history well enough, okay. but it occurs to me that the concept of heavy immigration restrictions and monitoring the border was not a founding concept of the United States. That naturalization, which is the process by which somebody becomes a citizen, was, of mm-hmm. course, and properly should be, I think. You know, that's mm-hmm. where the right to vote comes into play, and
right.
the privileges that come with citizenship and what have you. But the mere crossing of a line on the map in order to reside here and work here and engage in relationships and trade was not something that the founding fathers were particularly occupied with.
And if we look at the Mexican border, like personally, I am very much in favor of just human relations with everybody, and that's what I see. My grandfather
over a wall.
My grandfather. Well, a wall doesn't need to separate. It can protect assets that are of common value to everybody. I mean, we got four walls around this room.
You would, you know. you would compare. So you would compare it. This is what I'm hearing, and you tell me if I'm wrong. You would compare it to like a fence between neighbors, right? Where just if I erect a fence on my property line, mm-hmm. it's not because I hate my neighbor.
Exactly.
It's just because I want to be able to delineate between what's mine and what's his.
Well, even more to the point is so each of you can have your own private property, and that's what our society is based on. Now, I think one of the problems that's happening now is people do get upset about the employment situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of our people, obviously, they like to have these people come in and work. And Trump, from the very beginning, has said, I'm going to let all the good people come back. And he got trouble from Ted Cruz about that. You know, things have evolved. But he recognizes the contributions that the immigrants make, even the illegal immigrants. And this is a good thing. But we've got to secure that border, because that's not going to work. You know, Farmer Jones having someone pick his crop at a certain time on the season is great, but it's not going to work if we keep having people flooding across that, because they're not picking the crops for Farmer Jones, and they're just trying to get a better life, which we want. I think they could have a better life in Mexico. They should. And that's what I'm saying. My goal, and I've had this since 2010, is the first thing that I addressed was the Arizona situation and the border wall.
Uh-huh.
And it is this, that everybody is a human being and has to make a living and has to make it pay. They got to get a job and they make it pay. All of us from whatever country. However, what Trump is saying, and I agree, is, and Congress has agreed, is we need to secure the border. And because otherwise it just doesn't work. And people come in, to take jobs and then to run past, to do things. Now they're running. So many people are running drugs. Everybody's not running drugs, but we can't protect ourselves against criminal elements, nor can the Mexican immigrants themselves protect themselves when there's no order and there's just chaos.
All right, so that leads perfectly into another premise that I want to throw your way and have you react to.
Okay.
I have this sense, and it's admittedly a project under development in terms of this philosophical concept, that part of the many of the problems that we attribute to immigration, and you just cited, you know, the rise of the cartels, that's implicit in what you said, the drug trade,
employment,
the employment's one thing, the human trafficking is another. All of these things, to my mind, are products of black markets, which we've created with our own policy. By having the drug war, by making it illegal to engage in certain transactions, by having heavy immigration restrictions that creates a black market for the trafficking of human beings across the border, we've effectively created this pocket of anarchy in which government, by its own choice, does not exist. And when you have a situation like that, where people can't go to an institutional authority to resolve their complaints against their coyote or against their drug dealer or whatever the case may be, then it becomes a scenario where might makes right, and it's the rule of the brute, and that translates into all this violence that's often attributed to the border. Is there a connection there between the policies that we've adopted in terms of what domestically with the drug war and these immigration restrictions and the violence that we've seen as a result emerging out of these cartels and whatnot at the border?
Well, I think there is a policy problem, but it doesn't come from our side. It comes from the Mexican side. As I mentioned, I mean, one of the early popes gave the entire Western Hemisphere to Spain, to the Spanish king. And that claim has been exerted all the way up to Minnesota. This used to belong to Spain before the Louisiana Purchase. And it's ridiculous. But the reality is that Mexicans have been highly concentrated in the Mexico City area. I mean, it's the largest city in the hemisphere, always has. I think it's 30 million right now. It dwarfs any of our cities. And they don't care about the border. They're making a lot of money down there. They're very talented people. They got engineering. They invented the Zero.
All that may be true, but the point that I'm driving at here is that if you go and you talk to, and there's a documentary you can find on social media called The Wall that interviews ranchers who actually live down there.
Right.
And they'll tell you from their 40, 50, 60 years of experience living on the border that illegal immigration has increased exponentially. And they don't draw the connection, but the connection that I see is that it has increased right alongside the advent and expansion of the drug war and increases in immigration enforcement, which have created these black markets that suck people in. Now, the other side of that, I will grant you, which you've also addressed, is the welfare state and the economic draw of being able to come here for opportunity. So it's a multifaceted issue.
I'm not so much into that. What I'm saying is that They're not doing anything else with the border. Now, I talked with a Mexican man about my idea of the border states working together, including 10 Mexican border states south of the border. And he says they simply can't control the situation. There's been no development there, so it's wide open for drugs. We need a program where we show the people they can do other things than raise illegal drugs or traffic in illegal drugs, like we had in Afghanistan. So people can live safely, because everybody's living in half of these people are running away from that situation.
Right.
I was one of the early people who said, you know, there could be an asylum issue if they're shooting everybody and you're scared for your life. You know, there is one, but it's not one that we're recognizing right now. The other thing we can do is work bilaterally, which I have suggested since 2010, in the area of human rights and security. So we're cooperating with the Mexican government, whether it's those 10 states or with the support of Mexico City, to keep that area safe. I don't see why.
Does Mexico have any interest in doing that?
The 10 governors do. How many people got killed in the Mexican election so far? 120 people is the latest figure I heard. They're candidates, and they're killed in the election because they're trying to address this situation.
By the cartels.
Well, by people who don't want them to have a normal development on the border cooperating with the United States. So we need someone as a president of Mexico, whether it's Obrador or whether it's someone else, who's going to work with us as human beings, not to demonize us, not to demonize Donald Trump, but to say, yeah, we're all human beings, we're all one, and let's get along. Let's get along. And if we build a strong border with security, but also community, okay, with safety and security for everybody, people will want to go there because it could add to our gross domestic product, because we can make things. We can make cars, for instance, where we make the body of the car on this side of the border. We have an integration where with parts being outsourced to Mexican companies, and people can come there and create jobs.
I find myself really confused by what you're proposing, because sure, on the one hand, it sounds very much like free market, mutually beneficial relationships and transactions,
right,
but taking place across a 10 to 12 foot wall that people can't cross.
You know, I mean, the wall is in just the places that you don't have a city. We have walls, you know, there's like pairs of U.S. and Mexican cities. I know the El Paso and Juarez. Mm-hmm. They are a pair. Now, if you had more industry there on both sides, you don't really, from what I remember, you didn't have really much industry in El Paso, but you could. And you could all along the border out to California, and you can be creating, bringing back jobs from overseas, from China. You'd be creating cars. This is what GM does. If you look at GM, they're in Canada, they're in the United States, they're in Mexico. They're all over the place. And that's the government's now, right? I mean, very close relationship with the government. We can go in there and create industry and manufacturing. Like I say, these people are very talented. They manufacture a lot of things, including cars, cameras, computers. There's no problem with that. They need to kind of reorient their economy, and we should integrate ours with them.
All right.
And we could have a great future.
That leads to another issue involving the economy, which is tariffs. I want to get into that when we return. We'll also take a call from Mike in Farmington and anybody else who wants to contribute. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. Steve Carlson in studio with us, candidate for U.S. Senate running as a Democrat. My name's Walter Hudson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. We've got Steve Carlson in studio with us, candidate for U.S. Senate running as a Democrat with views very consistent with the current administration. He's a fan of Donald Trump by his own description. Let's talk to Mike in Farmington. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, I was going to try to make some points with your guest, and I'd be interested in his response as well as yours, Walter. I guess how I got started investigating this is when I started to hear about people in our country that were killed by people that were not here legally, and then you add in the gang component and the drugs and just the chaos and going to the wall, I think the wall in one respect would at least have some measure of control as to who is admitted into the country,
mm-hmm.
much like our house has walls and locked doors
mm-hmm.
to the home. I don't think the political establishment, be it generally, and I think it's proved out over the years, that they're really interested in solving this problem. And we've seen in the media that as the Russian collusion story has faded away, it's all about feelings and this uproar. And blaming Trump, I think, falsely for what's happening, because he's trying to enforce the law. I think these mechanisms and these things that are going into effect, those were in place before Trump even was on the scene. And we're not holding people accountable. I never hear about, or very seldom hear, the parents or coyotes or whoever these people are presenting children to the border. Basically, if you're taking small children hundreds and thousands of miles across these areas, to me, that's a form of child abuse. And we'd be prosecuting people and putting them in jail for doing that. But no, that doesn't seem to be addressed. And there are points of entry for asylum seekers. And for some reason, they're not using these points of entry. And I think the last administration made a conscious effort to bring as many people in as they could, just to overwhelm the system. And we could deal with asylum seekers, as the secretary had said, if they would seek ports of entry, but they don't. And we just have no accountability. And this has gone on for decades. And I think there was a news report earlier that we, at some point, we just don't have the resources for this. And why don't we hold these failed states accountable? I have a huge bone to pick with Mexico, because these people that came up from Guatemala and Nicaragua, they weren't stopped in Mexico. Mexico let them just ride right through.
We need two walls, huh?
And, well, Mexico is getting huge subsidies from our country through Western Union, people working here, sending money back. They're fine, I think, to have this situation to continue. And, hey,
all right.
I'm all for legalizing drugs. Just be like prohibition, but you know what? You got a lot of people in this country, judges, DEA, a lot of people making money by keeping this thing going.
No, I hear you on that. Let's let Steve Carlson respond. I appreciate your call as always, Mike.
Well, that was a oxymoron, I believe, holding failed states accountable. You can't hold a failed state accountable. And so, you know, a little bit of history, but ever since our beginning as a country, you know, people are talking about what a bad guy we are. I don't think we are. But we have been supporting democracy and democratic governments and independence from the other Western powers throughout Latin America, throughout its history. So that's what we need to do. We need to build Mexico up. We need to build these other Central American countries up. And I was going to mention my grandfather, Douglas Henderson, actually was a matador in all of those countries, and also a professional wrestler. Very colorful life he had. So I have actually relatives in Mexico. So I am totally relating to those people there. And we need to help them so they're no longer a failed state. Now, apart from that, everything Mike said is obvious and correct. And again, it's just like the immigration, the so-called ban thing. We need people to calm down and quit using this as a rhetorical device to drown out everybody else in the election with white noise during every election, which, by the way, you don't have debates. So all you have is all these screaming. So that's very well planned out by the Democrats. You have Keith Ellison doing it. You have Tom Perez doing it. They're trying to destroy Donald Trump as if he and Melania are some kind of, you know, Boris and Natasha, you know, kind of a couple that's gated in here. It's ridiculous. And these are important issues, and the Mexican people deserve our concern, not only at the border, not only the children, but all of them. Again, Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo of 1848, which created that border, it's based on good neighbor relations, and that's what we must have. And so for people like Vicente Fox to be coming out and saying, you know, F you or whatever to Trump is just ridiculous. And the same with, but they can't deal with Trump because they'll get undercut if they deal honorably with Trump. Too many people will undercut them in Mexico. They won't be president anymore. So we need to get, it's sort of like Kim Jong-un in a way. We've got to kind of get along.
All right, let's talk about dealing with other nations economically when we return. We'll talk about tariffs. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson. Steve Carlson in studio with us tonight, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So we've got Steve Carlson in studio with us tonight. He's a candidate for U.S. Senate running as a Democrat. And the reason, like the catalyst for bringing him in this evening was to talk about tariffs. That was the disagreement in the wake of our co-host, Bob Anderson, who is a candidate for U.S. Senate running as a Republican for the other seat that is up this year. The topic of tariffs came up during that conversation, and Steve was listening and started to engage me on social media, and that's why we have him in studio tonight. So let's finally get around to it here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Brad Omlin taking those calls and producing the show. So, you know, my take on tariffs in a nutshell is that they are inherently and always consistently economically destructive, because what they do is they disrupt the process of a buyer trying to seek the highest value at the lowest cost in the market. That there is no scenario whereby adding a tariff to a transaction, which is a tax, adding a tax to a transaction adds value to that transaction. And therefore, the idea that we're somehow going to tax ourselves to prosperity in the form of tariffs is inherently flawed. Your response to that, Steve Carlson?
Well, I think the idea that tariffs are never valuable is just historically wrong. Now, what you're talking about is something, you know, people will always say Smoot-Hawley, you know, in those sentences, and they're talking about the 1930s. But if you look at the beginning of our country, well, first of all, the tariffs funded the federal government, basically, instead of the income tax until 1917.
Just to pause on that point, because I think that's a totally legitimate statement. However, I think a distinction that we need to make is the tariffs that funded the federal government were universal tariffs. So it was a tariff on everything that came into the country at a certain rate for the explicit purpose of funding the federal government. They weren't targeted tariffs meant to protect particular industries such as the ones we're considering today.
And I don't think that's what Trump is trying to do. Trump is trying to get, in fact, he offered that everybody would drop their tariffs. But if you look back at the history again, you know, I did mention the 1917, and I was surprised to see that when I looked it up last year. But first of all, is protectionism. Now, this country was founded on protectionism. If you look at the extremely rapid economic growth of both the United States and actually Britain at the time that our colonies were founded, a lot of it was attributable to the Industrial Revolution. But that happened with the extreme protectionism. Where it comes from is the Britain government did not even allow us to make our own shoes. They would not allow us to ship our products to them or any other country in our own ships, because they wanted their British subjects to make shoes to sell to everybody with the new technology that made really good shoes, and to build ships.
But I mean, it sounds like what you're actually saying is that we rebelled against the protectionism of the British. No,
well, we had a war over that, but both countries exploded economically. That's my point. My point is that we had amazing economic growth during that time. And so you have to go back and say, well, why did we have that? And so what you're looking at is this really an ideological argument with certain industries who feel like they're hit they're hit by the trade war kind of, you know, a scenario. I'm not saying that it happens all the time that there's trade wars whenever there's a tariff, but you're right. From a strictly, rational, classical economics point of view, you know, it's going to be an added cost and then it's going to be passed on to the consumer.
So I appreciate you acknowledging that.
Yeah.
But you obviously believe that under certain circumstances, it's nonetheless the right thing to do. So describe those circumstances.
Well, for instance, you don't want to lose whole industries. Okay, so even though you might say there's a greater value to some set of consumers because you've had this also perfect, you know, classical economics, which you never really have. That's always it's never perfect. There's never perfect knowledge of any of the economic players. They don't know what the best prices are. They're basically engaged in economic activity. The good thing about the classical economics, you want to give people a chance to change their choices if it will benefit them. And I think,
but isn't that chance only available with the choice?
No, I think it's always available. I think everybody always has choices, and so.
But you're talking about taking away the choice by imposing a tariff, imposing a government restriction,
You're not taking it away, but I do think that it can be affected. And we don't want that. We don't want, if our farmers want to sell to China, we want them to be able to do that. And I think Trump wants that too. The big thing that's coming up now is the national security, okay? We were before they made that new budget deal, you know, after the debacle of the financial cliff and the shutdown of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And then Trump made a big, massive deal on the budget, which funded our defense, funded our military, because it was being held hostage by these politics. So that's a very good thing. But before that, we were losing control of our ability to set prices for steel and aluminum, as we have this buildup of the military, which we have and we're going to have. And we also will need that to produce more cars. So, for export and for use here at home. And so we need the steel. We need to take the iron ore out of, you know, northern Minnesota. We have plants that are shut down. I mean, if you're looking at the effect of, protectionism, I mean, look at northern Minnesota. What's that all about? It's about basically another country like China coming in and dominating not just the U.S. commodities market for iron ore and copper, but the whole world.
So let's explore,
we're at their mercy.
Let's explore that a little bit.
Sure.
Because when you talk about China dominating the market on something like steel or aluminum, there's a reason for that, right? Like the reason people would choose to import their steel from China is, again, because they're seeking the highest value at the lowest cost. So isn't that good? Like if your concern is national security and you want to be able to build up the military infrastructure of the United States in as efficient a manner as possible and get the most bang for your buck, wouldn't you want to get the lowest priced, highest quality steel available on the global market rather than just restrict it to what you can produce domestically?
Absolutely. I was looking at the other end of the production where people are taking all the ore. So the first time I became aware of China's massiveness when I was looking at like Australia, and they were buying up all of their commodities. They're buying up all of our commodities because they have a massive engine. Now, as far as steel production, the problem we've had with steel production is that we had the old style factories and foundries. And so that's what shut our iron ore down, is the other countries were able to produce steel much more efficiently because they had more modern plants, they had smaller plants, and we want those too. And now we need to get those. We don't want just to use the iron ore, but we don't want to be inefficient for our military. No,
you're a market guy, as I can discern from some of the things you've said.
Right.
What is it that motivates a business to improve its processes. Isn't it competition?
You know, if you look at World War II, that was one of the greatest engines for economic growth in our history.
So we need to go into more wars?
No, but people got to get serious, and we knew that they weren't always the cheapest prices. The thing about World War II production is quality control. Mm-hmm. It was amazing quality control. You've heard of, you know, built-in obsolescence. They were building cars that never broke down, so they couldn't sell any cars. And so we need to have that kind of quality, and that's going to make our goods more competitive. These things you can't control, like you say, they're controlled by market forces.
But this is, and we do have to go to a break.
Sure.
But in as concise a manner as you can address this, sure, this would be my question in response to that. How are you going to get there? How are you going to improve quality by eliminating foreign competition? Because that's what a tariff is for, right? Like the whole purpose of it is to neutralize the foreign competition so that you can make the domestic production viable.
Okay, let me just address that. If you look at our farms, now if we go into this tariff situation more deeply, our farming can be hit. But we have always had subsidies, and essentially tariffs and subsidies are the same thing, to help our farmers so we don't lose them. So, and we protect them against erosion, drought, and also changes in the market. And that's a helpful thing. It doesn't mean we don't want them to be the best possible farmers, but it means we recognize that these are important national resources. Steel is just as food is, and we've got to protect that. And that's what I see Trump doing. And because we haven't protected it, here in Minnesota, we've just lost massive jobs. And we can't have this. We've gone through the steel industry getting beat out by foreign competition, and now auto industry and the people in the Iron Range are in trouble. And that you heard that when Trump came, they know.
They are very grateful to the protectionism that they are enjoying.
Not protectionism, but the attention. How are they being protected? Because
what's the point of doing the tariff if it's? I mean, you just talked about jobs.
Yeah,
isn't a tariff meant to provide jobs for a particular industry? Isn't that inherent? Isn't that what protectionism is?
I don't think so. I think it's just to make sure you have an industry. What Britain was concerned about is they couldn't have a shipbuilding industry, which they used to beat the Spanish Armada. It was very key to their national security, and they did not want to let it get away. We need to also protect ourselves, and this isn't all going to be about tariffs. We want fair trade. And we also want national security. So I think that there's a basket of not deplorables, but good economic policies coming out of Donald Trump.
Steve Carlson, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. We'll wrap this up when we return. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Can't explain all the feelings that you're making me feel.
Short segment on our way out this evening with Steve Carlson in studio, U.S. Senate candidate running as a Democrat. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We got Barry in St. Paul on the line who has a comment for Steve Carlson. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for letting me come back on. So I think the whole idea is that the reason why tariffs are a problem isn't because what they do, it's because they give more money to the government, which gives them more resources to be able to grow bigger. And the conservative position would be to help out, if you want to help out these industries, if you want to help out business in the U.S., isn't by taxing it more to create more government, it's by reducing barriers, by reducing regulatory red tape, and by reducing taxes, thus starving the government, making it smaller by necessity, but also giving an advantage to our companies when they go do work overseas.
Appreciate the thought, Barry. I that resonates with me. I mean, one of the arguments in favor of tariffs that I've heard quite a bit from callers and from other sources doing research for the show is as a reaction to the encroachments by other nations. So people will talk about the slave labor in China. They'll talk about the
the flooding of the market with steel or whatever the case may be, all these manipulations that other governments do, which the premise there seems to be that when government involves itself in the market, it's bad. So why then would the answer to that be our government involving itself in the market? Got to hit that. There you go.
I felt that what Barry was saying was that he thinks that tariffs make the government grow bigger. And I would focus on that too. Yes, I have since 2010, the Move America Forward Act that I proposed was to shrink the federal government. We got to reduce the federal government. We've got to shift the power and the resources. All those areas that the Congress has preempted and taken away from the states have to be reduced and given back to Minnesota. I guess when we get like 78% of the money that we send to Washington, we get back to the state in some form. We've got to keep that money here. So we don't want tariffs to grow the government. And I don't know. Usually, I guess those companies are probably based in some state and they can get a lot of revenue from it. And I think that's very good. They have more of a business and they get more money back. I think that's great.
Speaking of federalism, one of the reasons why we have a federal government, one of the reasons why the several states at the outset, at the founding, decided that it'd be a good idea to come together and create a compact between them, which became eventually the Constitution of the United States, was in order to regulate commerce. And of course, that term regulate commerce is something that in the modern context means something very different from what it did at the outset. At the outset, it just meant to make commerce regular. And part of that meant not having tariffs and other economic restrictions between the states. Isn't that an admission, just the fact that we have that compact, an indication that there's value there in being able to trade freely but over political boundaries?
You know, that's certainly true, and we want that with the European Union, and we want that with all of our partners. And I think that is why we want fair trade. We would like to eliminate those tariffs. Now, the exception is a national security right now. But obviously, yes, we want trade with Mexico. That's what we need with Mexico. We need trade with China. We need trade with Europe, with Russia. Russia should be back in the G8. And yes, that's what we want. We want to spread that opportunity to the Middle East where they can diversify their economies.
Do you have a website that people can check out?
Yes, Steve Carlson for USSenate2018.com. Thank you.
Steve Carlson has been our guest in studio tonight. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Check us out tomorrow, 9 to 11 weeknights. Glenn Beck is next. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.